Hey, y'all. I'm Crystal Wilkinson, and I am Black in Appalachia. I began to see myself as a Black Appalachian. And then I questioned, like, why would I embrace this part of myself that sometimes doesn't embrace me? And then I decided that it's as much mine as it is anyone else's.
Podcast listeners, this is Dr. Nkesha Elamine, sociologist of race and place and Black Appalachian experiences. And today in the studio with me is the one and only
Crystal Wilkinson, poet laureate of Kentucky, fiction writer, professor at the University of Kentucky.
And y'all, you're listening to
the Black in Appalachia podcast. Whoop, whoop.
Freaking G. It is not every day that a girl gets to talk to a woman she admires. Shout out to the Black in Appalachia podcast for making all my dreams come true. But seriously though, y'all, for this episode of the Black in Appalachia podcast, I had the pleasure of talking with Crystal Wilkinson, Kentucky's poet laureate, award-winning author, one of the original Afro-Latchian poets, proud country girl, and all-round amazing Black woman. Crystal is certainly someone I look up to. I follow her on social media and just love seeing her win in these Appalachian streets. Like I said earlier, she is an award-winning writer. She has several wonderful books, including Perfect Black, which drops on August 3rd. So make sure you take your butts to your local bookstores, support Black bookstores, and get that. Water Street, The Birds of Opulence, and Blackberries. Crystal has the coolest eyeglasses. Y'all, like, follow her on Instagram. The brightest smile, and she's just a great spirit. I'm inspired by Crystal in so many ways. When I think about winning, like for me, you know, it's these opportunities to build relationships with people like Crystal Wilkinson and others that I really look forward to. And I'm just happy that we had a chance to sit down and chat for this podcast. Of course, we kicked off our conversation by talking about her childhood in Indian Creek, Kentucky, which is in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. If you've read Crystal's work or heard her talk before, then you probably know that she grew up with her grandparents, who were tobacco farmers and one of the only Black families in the community where they lived. Crystal told us that her grandparents owned acres and acres of land, and she had fond memories of roaming that land as a child.
Even though I've been gone so long, I still have a relationship to the land that I can't shake and don't want to. My grandfather had 64 acres. I sort of roamed those 64 acres all the time. I had a deep connection with the creek and with the fields and with the animals and all of that. And even though I'm a city girl now, I think about all of that fondly. And every so often I have to get somewhere to the landscape somehow to be sort of soothed by it. That's one of the threads in my fiction, is thinking about nature's capacity to heal for Black people, particularly for Black women.
And of course she had some not so fond memories of dealing with racism in her small town.
There were not a lot of young people when I was growing up that were Black. So it was me and my three cousins pretty much through from kindergarten all the way through high school. So there was a lot of racism and a lot of white people around.
Despite somewhat isolation, there was still a sense of community. And of course, the Black church was important in fostering that community.
There was also the sense of a Black community, and it mainly came from church. So we went to a really small Black church in Mount Salem, Kentucky, where almost everyone in the church was related to in some way. But that was sort of my indoctrination in community. I'm not really a religious person now, but I think the foundation of my beliefs, my morals, my values, how you treat other people, how you treat other Black people, how Black people should be in community,
In the context of these experiences, Crystal talks about developing her identity as a Black Appalachian and a Black girl from the country.
Growing up, my identity was country. And even then when I was growing up, country was, and I've written an essay about this, but country was sort of a cuss word. Country was a negative. I remember city cousins saying, they so country. And me thinking of that as a negative, and it was meant as a negative. So then there was a transition, I think, when I was in college that made me start to embrace it. Part of it had to do with leaving home. Part of it had to do with the health of my grandparents beginning to fail. Part of it had to do with being able to look back. You know, when you get away from a place and you can look back and say, oh, that was okay. I missed that. I want to go back to that. And so then after college, particularly when I got involved with the Afro-Latchian poets, there was this sort of transition into Afro-Latchia and into what it meant to be Black in Appalachia, what the word meant to me, if it was indeed a part of my identity or not. And I still go back and forth, you know, I still like, okay, yeah. Because so many people think of Appalachia proper as being no Black people or very few Black people live in Appalachia. But then when you start talking about various regions, most people think of coal mining when they think of Appalachia, and they only think of the mountains proper and not the foothills. And then there's all kinds of tension between the Appalachian Regional Commission naming certain counties. It's still, I think, an ongoing discussion. But for me, it was 30 years ago when I started looking at not just the geographical location, but started looking at other things and looking at foodways, looking at culture, looking at music.
We also talked about how she got involved in the Afro-Latchian Poets Project.
My undergrad degree is in journalism, and I was working for the city of Lexington, for Lexington-Fayette Urban County Government, as a public information officer. So I wrote news releases and speeches for the mayor or speeches for other sort of government officials. And that was one of those jobs, right, where I could just write something and hand it to somebody else, and I didn't have to go with it. I had a sort of closeted life as a writer of fiction and poetry. It's what I'd always done, and I always had them, you know, sort of tucked away. And I met a woman named Laverne Zabilski, who used to do something called the Working Class Kitchen. And she would have these poetry readings on Sundays at a restaurant here in town called Alfalfa's. And I would go and sit and watch and sort of leave the room because, you know, people would read and I would go, oh my God, I'm not reading any of my stuff. And then somebody else would read and they'd be real nervous like I was going to be. And I'd say, oh, maybe I can do this. And so I met Frank X. Walker at one of those meetings. He invited me to the Martin Luther King Cultural Center to sort of hang out with them where they were. I don't even know if we were named then, but we used to meet, read our poetry in sort of the back room of the King Cultural Center. And then we sort of got large enough that we moved. You know, we're about to have our 30-year anniversary. I had three small children, single mom, and I would take all my children to the poetry readings. Frank has photographs of me reading, and I think my twins were probably 2 or 3 years old, and they're like hanging. They wouldn't let me go up by myself, so they're like, I got one on each hip while I'm trying to read a poem. And I felt at home with them. You know, I had started sort of going out to writing conferences, and so I would go to the Appalachian Writers Conferences and I would be like, well, this is nice. You know, I'm learning some things, that people are nice, but they're all white. You know, I remember going to the first Hearst and Wright Conference and I was so excited. I'd seen an ad in Essence magazine. It was the very first one. It's a long story, but I ended up getting a job to let me use a vehicle. My mama kept my kids. I scraped money up and I was so excited. But then I was sort of outed as being country and I was disappointed because I'm like, I'm going to this Black conference and my instructor was white. And I was like, oh. So I felt like an outsider at the Appalachian conference because it was all white. I felt sort of as an outsider at the Black conference that I went to. But with the Appalachian poets, it felt like family. Kelly Norman Ellis was reading poems about her grandparents and her life growing up in Mississippi. Nikki Finney was reading poems about her people in South Carolina, Frank's folks in rural Boyle County close to Danville. And it felt like home. Their stories felt like home. The sense of family we had felt like home. And so it went on from there. And, you know, one thing that I still appreciate is, as a writer, my early inclinations about craft came from that group, because we went through deaths in the family, divorces, births of children, all of that stuff. And we were a tight-knit group. But when it came to sitting down and looking at the work and being honest about the work, we were always honest about the work. Like, this is a hot mess. You know, you need to, you know, page 15 is really not working, or whatever the issue was. And I think it made all of our work stronger.
I can imagine just how important it was for Crystal to find her group and what that did for not only herself and her identity, but also for her writing. And when I think about Crystal's experience as a Black person who grew up in Indian Creek, Kentucky, and her journey into her Appalachian identity, I know that those things are important for her and who she became, but also they're important for us as a region. I don't take for granted how difficult it can be for Black folks to really claim an Appalachian identity. And that's why I appreciate Crystal talking about how the Appalachian poets not only affirmed the development of her as a writer, like I said, but also just affirming that your experiences as a Black person in Appalachia are valid. They're legit. We had the same experiences, right? Like, we grew up with grandparents or grew up in the land or whatever it was. Like, that is something that is whole and it's okay. And so we see those experiences in her work, the affirmation of those experiences and of that particular voice in her work. When she talks about the connection to the land, the sense of community, the food culture, right? When she talks about these things, we see them over and over in her writing. And it reminds us that even as Black Appalachian populations are small, they're not insignificant. But because we have been excluded from mainstream narratives of Appalachia for so long, there are so many lost legacies of Black Appalachians, right? And again, that's why I think fiction and fiction writers are really important. They help us to recreate the memories, to fill in the gaps in the places where the archives have left us hanging. They really show us the power of imagination and leave generations, new generations, with something that empowers us to make our mark on this region. When we come back from the break, we'll talk with Crystal about her newest work, which is definitely a gift to Black Appalachians and the world.
Dig, if you will, the picture. Indian Creek, Kentucky, 16, Black, country, and full of sexual energy. I copied my style from magazines, bell-bottom jeans and blue peasant blouses and striped knit shirts that clung to my breasts, platform shoes and wooden candies high heels. I sprayed Avon Sweet Honesty perfume behind my ears and rolled on strawberry lip gloss. I sported an afro or a mushroom hairstyle or bone-straight bangs feathered around my face. I oozed sexuality, but I was a virgin. I was Christian, a timid member of the small congregation at Pine Lake Baptist Church, the church where my grandparents worshiped. I had an active imagination and a harnessed wildness. I kept secrets. When Prince sang Soft and Wet from a 45 on my record player, the lyrics were hidden beneath the funky beat. My grandparents never knew what I was listening to. Prince and his doe eyes, his big afro and glistening lean body, stared back at me from the pages of Right On magazine. We lived far out into the woods on a gravel road. My grandparents were farmers. Books and magazines and television told me that normal Black girls did not live like this, but I did. Prince was the sex I knew nothing about. Prince sealed my fantasies about a larger world. Pine Lake Baptist Church. One room with a coal and wood-burning stove. The Reverend stood on a riser with his pearl-handled cane and his Bible. Sometimes he spat in the midst of religious fervor, preaching on the lapping flames of hell and damnation. I felt as if he were speaking straight to me, that I would be doomed to hell for even thinking about sex. I would later atone in my diary. Let's call the man B.B. He was a distant relative. At the entrance to the church was a small vestibule with two white doors. Behind the doors was a dangling rope attached to the church bell. All us children, even as teenagers, grew ecstatic when we were allowed to ring the bell to signal the start of church. B.B. was head deacon in charge of bell ringing. The first time his hands brushed against my breast, I thought it was an accident. He groped me the next time I rang the bell. After that, he looked for opportunities. I began hiding, but he always found me, and I kept the secret. 1979. The white boys at school extended their hands into the aisle when I boarded the bus in the mornings. One grabbed a right breast, another grabbed a left buttock, another grabbed my crotch. I tried to use my books as a shield, but still the boys would get me, their hands taking what was not theirs. One boy grabbed his penis, another called me a nigger. Once I slapped a boy so hard the outline of my hand was written in red across his face. He called me ugly black bitch. The white boys laughed. The white girls laughed. At home, my room was filled with posters of Prince. Alone, under the glow of a cheap black light bulb, I danced to Sexy Dancer. I tried to wash off the stench of ugly black bitch, tried to remove the imprint of all those unwanted hands. Sometimes I was so full of shame and anger, I felt like I would rupture. Books became my conduit to the outside world. I had even begun to write my own. But my rural life in Kentucky felt like a prison. I wanted to get off the creek. Prince, my prince, beautiful, black, a few years older than me. He told me that I was desirable, that when I was ready, my body was mine to give. I was a sexy dancer, his sexy dancer, my own sexy dancer. That summer, I turned 17 and went to college. By the end of my first year, I had been raped twice, once by someone I knew and once by a stranger. I contemplated murder. I contemplated suicide. The dark, depressed moods I still live with were beginning to show themselves, threatening to spill into madness. One night I left my dorm room after thinking of ways to end my life and drove to a cramped nightclub. I danced to "I Want to Be Your Lover" with everything I had. Prince told me, "I want to be your mother and your sister too." I didn't worry about hell. I didn't worry about what my grandparents would think. The night I willingly had sex for the first time, I told my boyfriend that I was a virgin. It was the first time I had given consent to be touched. Sometimes in old photographs, I see glimpses of that young woman, corners of my mouth turned down, staring into the camera with empty eyes where joy should have been. In other photographs, I'm smiling so widely that I'm sure my face hurt. A taut body with a hip jutted out, a body drowning in unwanted touch. Sometimes I see the young woman in the mirror staring back at me through these 50-year-old eyes. When they told me Prince had died, I cried for both the young girl I used to be and the woman I've become. He taught me to be myself and taught me how to save myself again and again. His songs are this black woman's anthem, his voice, my respite. His wildness, the power I needed to find my own.
What you've just heard is Dig If You Will, The Picture, a poem in perfect black, Crystal Wilkinson's newest book, which is a memoir in the form of poems. This is her first collection of poems, and it consists of pieces she's written at different points in her life. This particular poem, which for the sake of time we can't really unpack, was a piece she wrote after the death of Prince.
When the Oxford American asked me to write about Prince, because everybody knows, I think I'm the number one Prince fan, they asked me to write. And so I was going to sort of make fun of myself as being this age and still being like wildly in love with Prince. I had never explored why. And so I started writing. And again, it was supposed to be a humorous piece. I wanted to write about when he died, like how I sobbed. We had our bookstore at the time and people came in and somebody showed Ron their phone and they were getting ready to say, you know, just to announce it. He shook his head like, no, don't say anything out loud. And then the person said, "Did y'all know Prince died?" And I just kind of collapsed and started bawling. Yeah, it was like a family member had passed away. I didn't know what that was about until I started writing this piece. It took so long to write that little short piece because every time it would go, you know, sort of to this dark place, I would go, no, it's supposed to be funny. Let's keep it light. And, you know, I learned a lot about myself from writing that.
One thing I know about writing in general is that the things that you write sort of have a mind of their own. And so what needs to come out is what comes out. But it was really interesting for us to see Crystal in this really vulnerable way, right? We are used to her fiction writing. This is new for us in the sense of she gave us nonfiction, but she also gave us poetry. And so we wanted to talk about why poetry and why now.
You know, I have always written fiction, but I've sort of secretly always written poetry. Every once in a while, a poem gets published here or there, but I've never had my own volume. As most writers do, I sort of walk around the same subjects all the time, with Black Appalachia being in the center of it. Themes of, you know, my mother's mental illness, of what it means to be a Black girl. Those things were always in the pieces. And I never thought I had enough poems that were themed to make a collection. Like, I've never sat down and said, well, I'm going to write a poetry collection the way that poets do. And I admire poetry, so I've never thought about a poetry collection. And a friend of mine wanted to see my poems for a project she was doing. And so I just sent her all of them. I didn't have time to go through the files, like, here, just look. And she said, well, you have a collection here. And I said, no, I don't. And she said, I think you should think about this. And so when I sat down and looked at sort of the body of my work in poetry, I did see a narrative arc. I did see specific themes, and I had to write some pieces to sort of bridge it. But between the poems and some of the flash nonfiction pieces that I had written, it was sort of there. And it sort of created this arc of, you know, the first part is all about girlhood. The second part is sort of like my rising consciousness as a Black woman. And then the third part is like being a Black woman now and dealing with motherhood and mother loss and all those kind of things. So it came together that way. So it's partly written for the time and partly compiled from past work.
So because this piece is a memoir, we see all of the ways in which it reflects those experiences that we talked about in the first half of this episode. Growing up in this region and sort of coming into yourself as a woman, but also as a Black Appalachian woman. And Crystal talked about that.
As a fiction writer, I think even in my poetry, sometimes, and poets do this, of course, sometimes there's a speaker of the poem that is not directly my experience, but adjacent to my experience. And so some of the pieces are that, but some of them are just sort of, you know, head on. So many of them are just like, okay, this is my life as I experienced it. And one of the things that's happened since I wrote The Birds of Opulence is that I used to sort of separate or have different compartments of my poet self and my fiction self and my nonfiction self. I think sort of with The Birds of Opulence and all the writing that I've done since, I write with one voice. So I bring my poet self to the page. I bring my nonfiction self to the page, and I bring my fiction self to the page. So this was sort of a hybrid emerging of that too. And I talk about some things that I've never talked about, you know, sort of straight on. So in some ways, this book was the most difficult to write, even though I didn't sit down and write it in the last year. But seeing all these pieces of my life sort of comprised in one volume and in a way that's not masked with fiction is sort of frightening. Like, I feel very exposed, even though people, I think readers don't realize where my exposure is, like always in these pieces. Because like I said, sometimes it's my direct voice, sometimes it's a speaker of the poem, but still it feels raw to me in some ways because I don't have these layers and layers of fiction on top of it.
And speaking of bringing herself into this piece, she also brought her partner into this. We found out that Ron Davis, who is also an artist, is the illustrator. It's like a double gift.
Ron made a post the other day, which was funny. He said that, you know, we got together late in life. We've only been together for about 13 years. We always wanted to have a baby together. So this is the closest that we've come. In some ways it is, you know, he had the poems and he sort of looked at them. And then there were pieces of his that I've always admired. For example, there's a piece in the book that we've never had a sort of formal wedding. And there's a piece in the book that we always sort of considered our wedding invitation. So that's sort of under the poem that I wrote for him, one of the poems that I wrote for him. And, you know, there's a story behind each of the illustrations. Some of it was me sort of telling him, oh, what about this for this piece? I'd like to have this and this and this. So some of them were illustrated properly, you know, what you would consider an illustration. And some of them, the visual work is in conversation with the more in conversation with the pieces than it being a true illustration. So it was fun. It's always fun for us to work together. We're both sort of cantankerous. So it's always, no one understands that part because it always seems like we're arguing and we're not, you know, we're not arguing at all, but we enjoyed the process.
So they have enjoyed the process of working on this together, and we get to witness what that union has sort of brought forth. But Crystal also talked about how rewarding it is and satisfying it is for her to be able to bring together all of these pieces from different parts of her life into one collection, and what that meant for her, but also to people who use her work, who are inspired by her work, who engage with her work.
I always get calls from teachers that they've seen a particular poem in print and they want a copy. And so I just email them a copy. Like Dear Johnny P's one that people always request, and there are other poems in the book. Sometimes people want to see the Water Witch poems about my grandfather. The O Tobacco poem was part of the original Afro-Latin poet film, Coal Black Voices. And so people ask for that one all the time too. So it's nice to have them all in one volume. So that part's been nice. And, you know, it's been exciting to see people have been posting on social media that they've got the book in hand. And that kind of makes me cheer and be like, they've got it. People have it. And it's weird because this is certainly not my first book. It's my fourth book. But sort of the vulnerability of this intersection between the poems that are really close to being about my life and the nonfiction pieces that are in it that are directly about my life, there's a different sort of vulnerability there than in fiction, which is both daunting and exciting. I have both emotions about it.
So in Perfect Black, Crystal Wilkinson's first collection of poems, you will get her real and raw and vulnerable, some poems, some nonfiction, all about her life. And if that's not enough, you've got illustrations by Ron Davis. So again, y'all, check this out on August 3rd, wherever you get books, your local bookstores, independent bookstores, Black-owned bookstores. You definitely want to pick this up. It's a quick read. All of us, our entire team, got copies. We did pre-orders. We're going to have her lead us out of this podcast with a reading. But before we do, I just want to remind you all to check us out on the socials. We are Black in Appalachia on Facebook and Instagram. Y'all, we just started a TikTok. Check us out on TikTok. You'll see all of the footage from our road show. Check out our website to learn more about that. We'll be in a city near you. Again, I am Nkechi Alamine. You can find me on Sewing Sociologist on Instagram. You can find the rest of the team wherever the hell they at. Shout out to the Black in Appalachia podcast team. William Isom, director, Chris Smith, our senior producer, and James Baines, our audio engineer. Now that all that's done, for you, a treat. Black and Fat and Perfect, read by Crystal Wilkinson.
Black and Fat and Perfect. He knows there is truth in silence, in the stillness of perfect black. Perfect balance, bliss from the kiss of ancient chance. They are patient as the clouds of dust in the corners, remnants of the sloughing off of old skins reborn in the us of them. Round tree to bark back, they lie in moonlight and haze till day breaks, and the dust floats into the light above them. A magical veil to cover their faces, a balm to heal all wounds. Light dances in the window and the work of morning begins. He brews the coffee. She turns the sausage. He scoops her waist from behind, cups the girth of her belly, and she is black and fat and perfect in his capable, warm hands.